Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, undercover videos recorded at ASU challenge the school's approach to diversity and inclusion.
And how a long-running string quartet works to keep its sound fresh.
But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Let me be clear. No Arizonan should be forced to amend a tax return because of shifting executive positions.
What are we doing exactly other than listening to a tiny and very loud minority of anti-American conspiracy theorists who can't stand the possibility that other people might vote?
This reaches to the level of administrative interference. We are in the middle of an election. I have had to pull certified elections officers off of this election to spend time compiling this report.
There's nothing in this I can't even call it legislation. Nothing in this concept that she's floating that would have prevented the subject that she doesn't like talking about, which is Sunshine Residential.
I never thought I'd find myself here. So I will obviously think about this. It's a serious decision. I just haven't made it yet.
They didn't talk to anybody. DHS didn't talk to the mayor, didn't talk to the council, didn't talk to the local school district, didn't talk to the nearby neighborhood. If this wasn't the federal government, then the city would say, hell no, you can't go there. That's a totally inappropriate site for the business that's going to be going on there.
And with me to talk about the continuing squabble over election responsibilities in Maricopa County, a legislative resignation, and more are Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Good morning, Barrett.
Good morning, everyone.
And Mike Hayner of Lumen Strategies. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Barrett, some changes could be coming to Arizona elections. We don't quite know which ones yet. The House and Senate are advancing slightly different proposals that would have to go to voters to see if they want to make changes. One of the biggest ones, though, potentially gives the legislature the option in the future of ending mail-in voting, which is something that the vast majority of Arizona voters use.
Yeah, it would be great to end voting for 85% of the people who vote by mail and vote early. Great option there. Look, if you want to vote at the polls, if you want to stand in line and fill out a two-page or three-page ballot, more power to you. You can do that. But if you want to, you know, for a generation, I mean, Mark, I don't even think you could vote when Arizona instituted.
I appreciate that, Barry.
Yeah,
thank you.
Arizona instituted vote by mail. It has been wildly successful and wildly safe and accurate. And no sane, reasonable person could say anything other than vote by mail is a success and people love it. Give the people what they want. And they clearly want. 85% want vote by mail.
Well, yeah. And Mike, I mean, as Barrett said, like so many people use this. If this were to go to the ballot, like could this potentially be a drag on other things? Like it seems like the campaign against the possibility of ending mail-in voting would kind of write itself.
Oh, definitely. The as Barrett said, 85% or more people vote by mail. If you're going to take that option away from them, they're likely going to not be happy and actually vote against it and potentially vote against all the other things that the legislature puts on the ballot because, well, if they're going to put that on, I don't understand these other things and they've got to be bad too because this one's bad.
One thing I will note is there's no cost to putting something on the ballot from the legislature. If you, mm-hmm. you know, remember, you know, last year, well, two years ago, you know, the legislature put on eight things. One or two of them passed. Most of them failed. There's no cost. They put 30 things on the ballot. There was no electoral cost, financial cost, anything to the legislature for putting something on the ballot. So they may put it on the ballot and it may lose. And you just go, oh, well.
Well, but there is a cost to the counties who have to print those ballots and all the poll workers who have to sit there for an extra time while people are filling out ballots, there is a cost to it.
Hopefully my wife isn't listening, but counties schmounties.
Wow. Hopefully she isn't listening. I mean, Barrett, do you think are these issues big enough where there could potentially be electoral costs if these are on the ballot and voters decide we don't like this?
I don't think so, because there's going to be so much other important things on the ballot, whether it's governor, Congress. Obviously, for the first time in a decade, we don't have a Senate race.
Yeah.
But we have the governor. We have obviously the members
all the
of Congress.
Statewide offices.
Every statewide office and the legislature. Those, and we'll have maybe some initiatives that will bring out people. There may be even a repeal of the marijuana statutes, the recreational marijuana. So there will be other things to bring out people. And again, you know, back to the mail-in, you know, if I've got to sit at my kitchen table and fill out a couple of extra bubbles, whatever, that's not a problem. But I don't think voters are so discerning that they'll go, I can't believe the legislature put this on the ballot. I don't think voters understand whether citizens put it on the ballot or the legislature put it on the ballot. It's just on the ballot. So I don't think there will be any cost to Republicans for that, other than it just overloads the ballot.
And remember, we've now moved the primary election to the end of July.
Yeah, it's a little earlier.
So I don't know. Do you get to stand out in 112 degree weather waiting for your turn at the polling place?
Well, look, what's the difference between late July and early August? It's still just north of hell in Arizona.
July with no early voting and early August with early voting. There's a giant difference.
And remember, you know, your listeners will like to know that there is a real possibility that the primary gets moved to May going forward, not this year. And starting in 2028, the primary would be in May.
Interesting.
Let's not go there yet. There's a long process.
Look,
before
Mark,
that.
If you can have me on in 2028, that would be great.
We'll book that. When we're done today.
May of 2028.
Mike, there is this giant kerfuffle going on in Maricopa County where the Board of Supervisors, which is controlled by Republicans, and the county recorder, who is also a Republican, can't seem to agree on a lot of things when it comes to elections. Who should be doing what? Who is proposing what? What is okay? What is not okay? There was a hearing this week where the recorder was sort of compelled to testify. He acknowledged that something that one of his staff members had said was not entirely accurate. This seems like, I mean, I don't want to characterize it, but I guess, how do you characterize it?
Insanity.
Okay.
It's a 4-1 Republican to Democrat board. This is a Republican county recorder who replaced a Republican county recorder. You would think again that they would be aligned in how they're going to do this. You know, the split happened, I think, when there was a Democratic recorder and the county board of supervisors took over certain functions. But let's just get together and stop wasting taxpayer money and get on the same page. Voting in Arizona is secure. As Barrett already talked about, early voting is secure. There is no fraud. There is nothing that people should be worried about in elections and counting ballots. And Maricopa County needs to figure out how they're going to move forward.
You know, Mark, a couple of recorder Justin Heap's employees under oath said that there had been some disenfranchisement.
Yeah.
The board asked, okay, tell us what that disenfranchisement, we want to know so that there isn't going forward. Tell us what that is. And Heap could not really explain that. And essentially, he sent the entire bus fleet of Valley Metro over his staffers in that meeting and really didn't defend them or, you know, didn't back up their claims under oath. And so I think, you know, I think we've gotten to the problem with a lot of some of these election deniers is they make wild claims. They have zero evidence.
So what does this mean? There are jurisdictional elections going on this spring. There's obviously, as we talked about, the primaries coming up over the summer. What does it mean that the state's most populous county at this point can't seem to get its act together on elections?
First of all, I do disagree with that. They are, you know, the board passed a resolution dividing the
duties,
and you know there is an ongoing court case of which the judge is like, hey, you guys really need to figure this out. The county board of supervisors has given Heap so much of what he has asked for, including IT positions, with which I don't think your listeners care who's doing the IT stuff. That's not really important, but something very important to Justin Heap. They've given him half of the IT staff.
Wait. I don't want the cyber ninjas involved in IT at the county.
Under contract, half of the ninjas will be there. There will be some ninjas.
I don't think that's actually true.
Okay. All right. I might be mistaken.
That part is not true.
I might be mistaken.
Is it concerning, though, that, Mike, that – I mean – yes, you know, as Barrett said, there is the board did propose a new what's called a shared services agreement to figure out who's doing what for elections, but it's not fully agreed to yet. Like, does it matter going into this summer's primary that, you know, in February there's still this acrimony between these parties over elections?
Yeah, it's concerning, but at the end of the day, it's going to get resolved. The election's going to happen. It's going to be run professionally and well. And again, there will be no fraud. The election results will be valid. Mm-hmm. And we've seen
a couple of elections on a small scale. Of course, the Congressional District 7 race to replace Raul Grijalva. Yeah. These elections pretty much went off without a hitch, or certainly a significant problem. So. This election will happen, and the board clearly is committed, and it's got a lot of experience doing elections, and so I'm not worried about Will. But it is just this fighting from the recorder's office, and it's unclear really what his goal is, because as we heard in the meeting, they won't even put in writing what they want, what the recorder wants. He will not put in writing what he wants, other than Supervisor Lesko put out a tweet. That's what we want. We want that 30-word tweet. Hmm. That's there. Give us a tweet.
Interesting.
Just put that in a order and boom, we're done. And it's like, it's got to be a little bit more.
Yeah. Mike, we saw what had sort of been rumored, speculated for a little while, became official when Gina Swoboda decided to leave the race for the first congressional district and run for Secretary of State. It seems, there's been a lot of speculation that, this is maybe a better fit for her. She is, she has been working in sort of the election space for a while. I'm curious what you make of her entrance into this primary and what it means for that primary.
Well, for the Secretary of State primary, it completely shakes it up. There was one candidate in office. That was it. Or running for that office. Now there's a primary. So who can raise the most amount of money? I think Gina Swoboda had President Trump's complete and total endorsement, along with Jay Feely for CD1, does that translate now into the Secretary of State's race? If it does, that changes dramatically how that race looks. And I think that she becomes the front runner if that endorsement holds.
So Alexander Colladan, State Representative, had been, as Mike alluded to, the only candidate in that race. What does it mean now that there's an actual competitive primary there?
Oh, I think it's a big deal, and it's important. The Secretary of State is the chief election officer, even though they don't run elections. There's no way that Adrian Fontes, Katie Hobbs before, can change ballots. But it is an important office, and currently it's the second in line, though it won't be come next year. But Gina Swoboda, absolutely. First of all, she has the experience in elections. She used to work at the Secretary of State's office. Mm-hmm. She ran the Republican Party.
Under both Republican and Democratic Secretaries
Absolutely.
Of State. So
she actually knows what she's doing. That's the kind of candidate I would want. And also, she's not an election denier. Obviously, she has questioned some things about elections and wants to better improve the process. But if you look even, in 2024, she had her, did videos and had her whiteboards.
Yeah, when she was chairperson of the Republican Party.
Absolutely. Explain, debunking some wild conspiracy theories that were being pushed by Republicans. And she was willing to say, look, this is what is actually happening, and it's not wrong. It's not a conspiracy theory.
But can she get out of the primary?
Absolutely, 100%. She's conservative. She believes in real election integrity, not election integrity for Republicans only to win. And so I do believe she can certainly get out of the primary. Look, it is sort of a less well-known office, if you will. It is an office that doesn't get a lot of attention when we start talking about races. But I also think, for Mike's party, if Gina Swoboda does get out of the race, I think that kind of spells doom for Adrian Fontes.
Yeah.
You just heard it. Yeah. Yeah. You just said yeah.
Gina Swoboda, again, I think is a very good candidate for that office. And she's probably got better name ID than Alex Kaledin does because she was the chair of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. She's worked with the Republican activists across the state. So, again, I think she does have that. Now, when it comes to the general election, it's going to be hard for anybody to beat an incumbent.
Yeah, I do agree with that. But what Mike won't want to acknowledge is this is still a Republican state. It's not really that purple. It's certainly not a Kerry Lake state, but it is a Republican state. And so I would think that if Gina comes out of the primary, she has the upper hand because moderate Republicans and right-leaning independents will vote for her as opposed to say, I can't stomach Kaledin just the way they couldn't stomach Fincham and vote for Adrian Fontes.
Well, that's why I was wondering about the primary, because she is not really a favorite of the Freedom Caucus Turning Point
Correct.
Crowd. I mean, that was sort of the knock against her in the congressional race, that she didn't really have those parts of the Republican Party in her corner. Is that a problem in a primary? That seems like those are the people who tend to vote.
It is a problem in the primary, but oddly, she's got to do okay in Maricopa, where I think Turning Points is more prevalent, and really do well in rural and Pima. And if she can do that, then she can eke out that primary. But it's going to be close.
Yeah, remember, she had the support of the grassroots
right.
throughout. Turning Point has been against her most of her chairmanship, and they tried to ditch her during her chairmanship. And a lot of the legislative districts voted in support of her. And so she has the grassroots support.
Hmm.
So, yes, Turning Point will be a factor for sure. But Gina has done a lot of work over the years, has won, by the way, has won a lot of races. As chairman, she expanded majorities in the state legislature. She won some statewide elections. The entire Corporation Commission mm-hmm. is Republican, expanded the majorities of the legislature. So I think, raised money. I do believe Trump won under her, didn't win under Kelly Ward. So I do think she has a lot of grassroots support, if certainly not the Turning Point support.
So the race she's leaving, Barrett, the first congressional district, this is the seat that David Schweikert is leaving to run for governor. So it's an open primary on both the Democratic and Republican sides. Joseph Chaplick, state representative from Scottsdale, announced just yesterday that he's going to be resigning from the legislature next week to focus on that race. Jay Feely, the former Cardinals kicker, CBS sports sideline reporter for the NFL, has the president's endorsement in that race. There are a few other candidates in there as well. Does it – like what does Swoboda's exit and Chaplick's seeming full-time focus on that race mean for that primary?
Well, Mark, I think it just comes down to Donald Trump has endorsed Jay Feely and the race is over. I guess we'll still have to vote in July, but the race is over.
Remember, it's a complete and total endorsement. So be very clear. It's complete and total.
Right. Could Chaplick also end up with an endorsement in that race, do you think?
No.
You think it's just Feely's?
It's just Feely's.
And so then how does assuming that you guys are right and that Jay Feely comes out of that primary, how does a Jay Feely versus whichever Democrat wins that primary shake out, do you think?
I think it's going to be very difficult for the Republicans to hold that seat. This midterm is going to be a referendum on the administration, ICE, Minnesota. At least today, that's what it's going to be about. And it's going to be very difficult for the Republicans to hold that seat, whether it's Jay Feely or Joseph Chaplick or any of the other candidates running.
What do you think, Barrett?
Well, look, we got 8 months. And so, I can't predict to you what will happen next week because it is it's just a crazy time in America. If the economy is doing well and, crime is down and all those things, Republicans do have a shot. It's a very competitive seat for sure. Depends on who the Democrat is. But, if the economy, isn't doing so good and, we see more of these immigration really aggressive moves, certainly in the Phoenix area, as are rumored to be, Democrats have maybe a better shot. I don't know if we're really going to talk about this, but, there's a bill in the legislature that would demand counties ask for – ICE agents.
ICE at polling places.
At polling places.
It's like, up for debate today in committee.
And, you know, Donald Trump did a lot of work to attract Latinos. And he did well. He did better than any president since George W. Bush. And that is going away. All right? That advantage is going away because of these ICE raids where they're not just taking the worst of the worst. They're taking my abuelita, all right, and some guy at Home Depot. And I think that is a danger for the losing the Latino vote, which obviously is kind of big in Arizona. So we'll have to see how that goes. That's going to be a huge determination. But the economy will be the big thing. And, you know, big decision today at the Supreme Court about tariffs. We don't know where the economy will be in the next few months. And that's going to be
Or are we starting a war with Iran?
We might not be here after next week. This is all for I'm going to lose my 2028 slot at KJZZ because, you know, we attack Iran and that's done.
So, Mike, let me ask you about the ICE at the polling places. And I would imagine that this maybe will set a record if it gets to Governor Hobbs for how quickly she vetoes it. But is this – like, could this potentially be a talking point for Democrats going into the election? Hey, look, you know, we don't want – ICE at polling places. Republicans want ICE at polling places.
Definitely a talking point. But again, it's all about voter intimidation. And we've seen this in bills passed, you know, over the years. It's designed to shrink the number of people that vote so that you can get the outcome that you want in the election. So this is about voter intimidation.
Do you think it makes it to the governor, Mike, this bill?
Yes.
Do you think it makes it to the governor, Barry?
Probably. But, I don't even think it gets out of the door of the Senate by the time she stamps the
– Would she go to the legislature to veto it?
Yes, I think she goes – she intercepts the runner and she just – give it to me. I'm going to save you steps. You're not going to get your steps in today. I'm vetoing it right here.
She would have floor privileges in the Senate being a former Senate member. So she could just go down and wait.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean – you know, why have, you know, any kind of drama? Just, veto it right there. You know, give it to Jake Hoffman and say, here you go with my compliments.
We'll have to see if that happens. All right. Barrett Marson, Mike Hayner, thanks so much for the conversation, guys. Appreciate it.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the quest to preserve the history of a women's-only community in Tucson.
But first, a pair of controversial videos released in January purport to show two ASU professors saying the university is still pursuing the spirit of DEI initiatives, even if they're not using that exact language to describe them. The videos were produced by an organization that calls itself Accuracy in Media. In them, people posing as prospective students enter the professors' offices to ask if inclusion and diversity are still part of the university's curriculum. The heavily edited videos depict the professors giving answers, suggesting the ideas are part of the school's thinking in terms of how programs are shaped. Videos of a similar nature, also produced by Accuracy in Media, have led to firings at other universities. State Press reporter Andy Ruiz noticed the videos targeting ASU and reported on them earlier this week. When I spoke to Ruiz this morning, she told me she was immediately struck by the video's confrontational style.
And so I kind of went down a rabbit hole, and I found that this media watchdog organization, Accuracy in Media, has been doing these, quote, undercover investigations into multiple universities across the United States, where they send a reporter acting as a prospective student and kind of have them ask questions surrounding if the university is still maintaining DEI policies, if they're still using DEI language, inclusive, diversity, equity language, to kind of get these professors to speak more about it and what the university is doing.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that in the video, the quote-unquote prospective student is sort of pitching themselves as somebody who is hopeful that the department in question has, quote-unquote, inclusive policies.
Yes.
I was hoping to find out exactly that, like if there's still inclusive curriculum in the criminal justice programs. And
I think that there definitely is that within the curriculum, although you're not going to see the reference as predominant as it was perhaps 2 years ago.
Okay.
But it's still very much a part of the conversation.
And within these videos, you see the president of Accuracy and Media, Adam Gillette. He goes into their office and confronts them about these undercover videos.
Your department was doing DEI in defiance of the federal executive order. Is that true?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, is this you on the video right here?
To be clear, we should say in these videos, Gillette accuses the professors
yes.
of, quote unquote, breaking the law.
Our investigators met with administrator after administrator who bragged to us about continuing to push these radical ideas even when they're against the law.
My first question when seeing these videos was, who is this organization?
Mm-hmm.
Why is this kind of a really passionate type of coverage for them? And why are they using these methods? And why Arizona State University?
What is the current status of DEI restrictions at ASU?
Yeah, so when I was speaking to an ASU spokesperson, they mainly referred me to the Arizona Board of Regents policy manual that prohibits unlawful discrimination, harassment, and retaliation on the basis of a protected class, including also the state constitution and that prohibits preferential treatment or discrimination using a similar standard. And so the university just basically said that they fully comply with the federal law and does not discriminate in admissions or scholarship decisions, and saying that university still follows these policies and these ordinances.
Yeah, and the whole situation yeah. around DEI in academia is sort of murky at the moment. There was President Trump's executive order, which stated that if universities wanted to receive federal funding, they had to remove DEI
yeah.
language and officers. That's not the same as making DEI illegal.
Definitely. And I think, like, looking at it from a journalism perspective, when I was that's mainly the reason why I wanted to meet with a media ethics professor to get an expert opinion on this, because I think when you see the video without any prior context, it can be a little misleading, I would say. And so I felt like it was a really good addition to reach out to Steven Adler. And
Steven Adler, who we should say is the director of NYU's Ethics in Journalism Initiative.
Yes. And I think one of the biggest takeaways from his interview that he doesn't look at this from journalism. He's looking at it as a perspective that it's undercover political activism. And I think that's a really important part for readers to kind of take away.
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and you spoke to Adam Gillette as well,
yes.
right? Who's the president of Accuracy in Media, the organization that made these videos.
Yes.
He, I believe, used the word ruse
yes.
to describe what they're doing.
Yes. So when I went in, my main questions were kind of, how are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And why do you think it's important to your audience? Why do you think it's newsworthy? And why do you think there's a need for this kind of coverage? And he was just like, mainly saying he's very proud of these reporters and that they're very skilled reporters that are able to come up with compile some ruses to get this kind of information from these professors. I brought up the SPJ Code of Ethics, and I was saying that
that's the Society for Professional Journalists.
Yeah, they have their own guidelines for reporters going undercover and these kind of news gathering methods. They recommend that journalists avoid undercover or other methods of gathering information that are kind of, I would say, where you're kind of lying to your source. And unless, like, traditional or open methods will not yield information vital to the public. So, like, my main question was to him in regards to those guidelines were what kind of made the decision that you thought this information was so vital to your audience, to the public, that it was necessary for, I would say, a very controversial method in the journalism world. He mainly said that he did believe that this information was really vital to the public and to feel the need to bring this to light surrounding DEI policies that may be undercover or universities lying to their students, as he would describe.
He's calling these people who are pretending to be prospective students and going in and recording these videos I think he refers to them as undercover investigative journalists.
Yes.
Did he give you their names?
Every time I would kind of ask that question of who are these people? Why are they doing this? How are you getting them doing this? He would kind of give the very much same answer, saying he's very proud of these investigators. I would say he would applaud them for being able to get this information. And, yeah, he would describe them as undercover investigators to be able to get this information. And so I wasn't able to get the names of the people who were getting these who were recording these professors.
So the professors who are shown in the videos, Chandra Credup, mm-hmm. correct?
Yes.
And Rebecca Loftus. Chandra Credup is the associate dean of Watts College. Rebecca Loftus is the director of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. In the aftermath of these videos where they are shown talking about how the university still adheres to the values of inclusivity in principle, what has happened since these videos came out with respect to those two professors?
What I know in talking to an ASU spokesperson, there has been no change in their employment. Nothing has really happened. I reached out to both of them and they both declined for a request to comment. And so I would say there has been no changes to their employment or to their status at ASU. They basically they declined to comment on it, and ASU kind of said they were aware of this, but they don't respond to any kind of secret recordings or any content that was featured in it. They just basically said they don't comment on these, and that the employees that they were not authorized to kind of speak on behalf of the university. So just like that, and so. Mainly the reason why I wanted to bring this article to light is that much of the ASU community did not know that this was happening.
These types of videos.
Yeah, these type of videos. I thought it was really important coverage, not only for students, but also for professors as well.
Well, I have been speaking with the lead politics reporter at the State Press, Andy Ruiz. Andy, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
This is Haydn's string quartet in D minor, played by the Takash Quartet at NPR's Tiny Desk concert last year. The group has been performing in different iterations around the world for around 5 decades. It'll be part of a concert series put on by the Phoenix Chamber Music Society tonight in Paradise Valley. Through all of the changes, one member of the original quartet remains, cellist András Fejér. He will, though, be retiring at the end of the season after 51 years. I spoke with Fejér earlier and asked how he describes what the Takash is.
Well, I flatter myself by describing us that a classical music group playing many, many gorgeous pieces from composer, starting with Haydn and ending in the contemporary list of wonderful today's composers.
And that includes some compositions that have been written specifically for your group, right?
Ever since Harumi joined the quartet, our commissioning and playing contemporary music at least tripled. And it's wonderful because she's got personal contacts with most of them. And in fact, she's already been championing many pieces of these wonderful composers, and we are happy just to trust her judgment and smilingly reap the results.
Ah, how would you describe the evolution of the sound of the quartet? You mentioned that you've, you know, sort of recently started, you know, playing some more modern composers, some commissions. How would you describe the way that the sound of your group has evolved over the decades that you've been doing this?
Well, I'm working and playing within the system, so I'm not the right type to judge, but I wouldn't describe our playing as the actual sound changes. The guiding principles have always been the same, namely, just give your best to describe the character of the music with the right attitude and expressivity. And once we decide that, then how can we project it towards the audience that they would have the same feeling and they would feel the same joy and admiration for the pieces, what we do.
So I think it's worth mentioning, this quartet has been around for more than 50 years now, and you are the only member who has been there the whole time. What is that like for you to see different, you know, colleagues sort of come in and leave over those, you know, five plus decades?
Funnily, it has never been about numbers or years played together. It's always been about the repertoire, how many Haydns or Beethovens or Brahms or Bartoks or contemporary pieces we are supposed to play in any given seasons. Once that's decided, we just start to work. If after 5 or 10 years we return to the same piece, it will still be a Haydn or a Beethoven, just slightly different because we change what we learn or read about certain pieces. They all change, or one of us or many of us wishes to change some color or trying a different idea. Those are all something which are in flux. So all the time, it's a wonderfully ever-changing organism.
How do you go about trying to decide what changes to make and how to make them? I mean, there are four of you. You know, you're sort of the senior statesman there. But what's the process like for saying, okay, we've done this before, let's maybe try it differently this way, or we've never done this before, this is the way we think we should do it now?
When we were young, restless, and naive, we thought that the only solution to any problem is my way or his way. But after 10, 15 years listening to master tapes or various radio recordings, we realized that unlike in many departments of the big picture of the world, in music, in phrasing, there are no one good solution. So many things can work as long as A, we have an argument that the composer might have thought about it this way, or B, that it's convincing as is in its new present form.
Well, that's interesting. So you sort of take a step back and think about what the composer might have been thinking before you take any sort of, I don't know if you would consider them like radical changes, but like you don't want to sort of step outside what the composer was thinking interpreting it.
No. In our upbringing and ever since our first wonderful coaching with András Mihály at the Franz Liszt, the first and foremost thing was, what did the composer want? Or in most cases, as we didn't get any letter from Brahms or Haydn, you know, what is it what he possibly wanted based on our knowledge of the matter or knowledge of his other pieces or knowledge of various paintings from the same era or literature? Those are all little helping hands to confirm or contradict whatever we wish to do. So it's a fascinating thing. and we keep arguing. That's how we still feel fresh, and hopefully the audience would feel the same way.
Yeah. All right. Andras, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
I thank you, too.
Andras Feyer is the cellist with the Takash Quartet, which will be performing tonight as part of the Phoenix Chamber Music Society season at Camelback Bible Church. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Picture this. A separatist community in the middle of the desert made up entirely of women. It was a real place outside of Tucson called Adobe Land, and the no men part was one of the only rules. Adobe Land was what's called a women's land. That's women with a Y. They were also called lesbian lands, and some still exist today. The movement began, according to our next guest, in the 1960s, when back to the land movements, feminism, and radical lesbian separatism all converged. Women's lands gave lesbian women a place where they felt safe and gave them some control over their own destiny. Adobe Land was founded by a woman named Joan Pepper, a.k.a. Adobe. She bought 10 acres in the desert outside Tucson and invited other like-minded women to come and live with her. Penelope Starr is a Tucson author and storyteller who first heard about the community from a storytelling event and tried to create a documentary about it that never came to fruition. She wrote about it, though, in a book called Desert Haven. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with Starr more about it and what Adobe Land was like.
Their conditions were fairly primitive. At first, they didn't have any amenities. She kind of organized it as a campsite. And she had to put in water and electricity.
Tell us about the philosophy, like what would draw women there when they would come?
Well, it was kind of a national phenomenon at the time. There were books published on lesbian lands that had listings. You know, there's always been an underground network. So people would find out about it from all over the country. So they would come there. And the philosophy was basically, do your own thing, don't get in anybody else's way, and no men.
And no men. Describe for us what the reaction was from the broader culture to this idea of women's lands at the time. Like, did people think they were crazy? Did people think they were interesting? Like, was it sort of a novelty?
I don't think very many people knew about it.
Huh.
It was pretty much an underground thing. When I talked to people about the fact that we were trying to do this documentary film, people would say, what is Adobe Land? And they've lived in Tucson all their lives. It's a half-hour drive from my house, you know.
Wow, yeah. So tell us that story about how you heard of this and why it kind of piqued your interest.
Well, I was working at Wingspan, which was Tucson's LGBTQ community center, and I was running the senior program. And one of the programs we had was called A Colorful Life. And we would interview seniors and let them talk about their lives for a little while. I was doing storytelling at the time, so this was kind of a natural for me.
Yeah.
And someone suggested that we go out and interview Adobe because she was getting older. And this is all the history that we were trying to preserve.
Mm-hmm.
So two friends and I, Luann Withy and Pat Wolke, decided that we would take a camera and go out to Adobe Land and see what we could see.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we got there, Adobe was no longer on the land. She was in a nursing home.
What did you find on the land?
Some trailers, some underground houses, some very ambitious projects that were finished or not finished. There were people living there. One woman had been in a trailer there for, I don't know, 30 years or something. One woman had built a Cobb house, like an Adobe, only it's Cobb. So it was a real mixed bag. And the people who were there was a real mixed bag, too. People were there for a variety of reasons.
Tell us about them.
Well, I went through some of my papers, and I realized that at least, a dozen people that we interviewed aren't alive anymore.
Hmm.
So I feel very privileged that I had the opportunity to talk to some of the old timers and find out about what their lives were like. A lot of them were pretty transient. They were dropouts. That's what we used to call it. I don't know what they call it now.
Not people, high school dropouts, like society dropouts, right?
yeah. It was people who just didn't want to live in the culture the way it was trying to define them. So they're trying to define their own lives. Hmm. They lived what you'd call alternative lifestyles.
Yeah.
They were much more willing to give up certain amenities in order to have the freedom. So it didn't cost a whole lot of money to live out there. Adobe never really asked people, you know, they were supposed to pay a few dollars to stay there. Some people did, some people couldn't afford it.
Right.
She would never ask anybody to leave. She was a very open-hearted, very loving person.
Hmm. So you did a lot of interviews, as you're describing here, with some of the folks who lived there and some of the folks who had lived there earlier in an attempt to make a documentary about it that never came to fruition. But you did use a lot of those interviews, I understand, as inspiration for a book that you wrote. So, I mean, tell us a little bit about your impressions of this and why it was something you were so interested in and pursued for so long.
Well, I think one reason was I was so inspired by these women who were brave and kind of crazy to go off and try to create a new society.
Yeah.
Something that was separate and had different values. They honored the earth. They honored relationships. That's not to say there weren't problems. You know, anytime you get people together, there's always possibility for conflict. But their guiding principles was pretty much to be independent women and take control of their own lives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Outside of the patriarchy, outside of the rules that have been imposed upon them. There was a woman who was there just because she wanted to be away from the world and didn't really want community, but it was a safe space for her to be.
Yeah.
There was a woman who'd been there through various partners, you know, so she'd stay, her partners would come and go, that kind of thing. There was somebody who left because they couldn't afford to stay there anymore. So all of those stories are part of the bigger story of women's land.
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly about the state of some of these women's lands today, right? Like there are, as you said, some that still exist, but it sounds like they might be having a harder time keeping going in today's world.
Well, part of the problem is that if these lands were started 40, 50 years ago, these women are aging out. They might need care, or they might need to be closer to medical facilities, and they're trying to attract younger women. And there's a certain amount of success that comes with that. But, you know, the future of these are all pretty precarious. Mm-hmm. The ones that are land trusts have a plan for the future, but sometimes a women's land could be a couple of acres that somebody had and let other people live there, and that person has to move on, and then what happens to the land?
Yeah.
But there's a directory, and there's dozens and dozens of lands in various states of solvency. And some of them are, a lot of them actually are saying, come on, you know, we have space, come here, try this out, see how important it is, see if it's for you.
Yeah. Well, maybe someone listening will try it out. That is Penelope Starr, the founder of Odyssey Storytelling in Tucson and the author of the book Desert Haven, joining us to talk about Adobe Land in Tucson and women's lands all around the world. Penelope, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for telling us about this. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Lauren. I'm really glad that you're interested in it.
Well, that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Don't forget to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is a good read. It's called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org.
The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you again on Monday morning. Have a great weekend. ¶¶